So good afternoon, everyone. My name is Chad Rhodes, and I'm a former staffer of Senator Tom Tillis. It is my honor and privilege to introduce our keynote event today, which features a discussion between United States Senator Tom Tillis and the Honorable Robert T. Numbers II. Senator Tillis was first elected to the United States Senate in 2014 and was then reelected again in 2020. Before he was elected as United States Senator, he served as the Speaker of the House of North Carolina from 2011 to 2014, where he was instrumental in reforming North Carolina's tax system, regulatory reform system, and criminal justice system. When he arrived to the Senate in 2015, Senator Tillis was assigned to the Senate Judiciary Committee, which I know made at least one of his staffers pretty happy at that time. And he remains there today. During his time on the Senate Judiciary Committee, he has played a critical role in evaluating and confirming hundreds of executive appointees and federal judges, which include Justices Brett Kavanaugh, Neil Gorsuch, and Amy Coney Barrett. Senator Tillis is also a ranking member of the Senate Judiciary Subcommittee on Intellectual Property, where he focuses on protecting our national intellectual property system. In addition to that, he also serves on the Antitrust, Immigration, and Oversight Subcommittees. Senator Tillis and his wife, Susan, live in Huntersville, and they are the proud parents of two grown children and grandparents to two granddaughters. Leading our discussion today is the Honorable Judge Robert T. Numbers II. Judge Numbers, United States Magistrate Judge here in the Eastern District of North Carolina. Prior to 2014, Judge Numbers practiced in Winston-Salem and in Raleigh and was involved in the Federalist Society as the chair of the Winston-Salem and Raleigh Lawyers Chapters. And with that, I'll turn it over to Judge Numbers and Senator Tillis.
Good afternoon, everyone, and good afternoon, Senator Tillis. We are all very, very appreciative of you taking time out of your busy schedule to be here with us today at the inaugural North Carolina Statewide Federal Society Conference, and look forward to talking with you over the next 30 minutes or so about your experience in the Senate.
Well, thank you, and I would apologize for being a little bit underdressed, but it would be insincere because I'm really comfortable.
Fair enough. So as Chad mentioned in the introduction, obviously before you went to the U.S. Senate, you served for years in the North Carolina House, both as a member and then as Speaker of the House. Can you share some thoughts on your transition from the state to the federal systems, and how did you get acclimated to that new environment? Was there anyone who gave you good advice on the ways of the Senate or how to kind of make that operation work better?
It was probably 3 or 4 months into my first term. I was in the Senate gym, and Senator Roy Blunt from Missouri came in, and he said, "Tom, how would you compare the House to the Senate?" I said, "A lot like a microwave and a crock pot." I mean, seriously, if you take a look at what Tim's done and the House and the legislature over the last 4 years, and what we did for only the second time in 100 years when we came into the majority. And you think about regulatory reform, tax reform, making hard choices on balancing the budget, annexation reform, Second Amendment rights, life policies, all of those things were done in 4 years. Many of them started in the first two. And this is just when we were finding our way around in the leadership. If you were to take the key pieces of legislation that we did in 4 short years, and I were to try and predict how long it would take to get the same things done in Congress, it would be a decade or more. And so then you have to step back and realize that's the world we live in, the world's most deliberative body, and I believe that it is. It's hard to get things done, and it should be, as the founding fathers intended. But I think it goes down to, it's really probably the person that I observed the most was Lamar Alexander. Now, Lamar had been elected to the leadership from Tennessee. He had been elected to the leadership and chose to resign because I was talking with him about, you know, do I potentially move into leadership? I was sorting it through, and he said, "Well, Tom, you just have to decide. You can lead without being in leadership. It means you're going to focus more time on legislating." And I really took that to heart, and I started observing how he was so successful in getting things done. And he did it through relationships, through tenacity, and every once in a while, Lamar seems like a very calm guy, but when he gets mad, you pay attention. And so putting those things together are really, were probably the most instructive to me in terms of how I built relationships on both sides of the aisle, and how disciplined I try to be in terms of moving legislation that's important.
Yeah, and you mentioned the relationships you have with other senators. There was a recent article about you called Tom Tillis and the Art of the Deal, which covered in detail your ability to work with senators on both sides about to get legislation passed. And can you talk about your approach to relationship building, and particularly with those who may have differing views from you?
Yeah, I'll give you a good example. How many of you know who Sherrod Brown is from Ohio? He's a liberal dude. And right now he's the chair of the bank. And I tell him that too. So if this is being recorded, he'll just smile. But I think you got to treat everybody with respect, right? Elizabeth Warren and I have worked together on one area, so if you're in banking, don't worry. But you try to figure out where their passion is. So Mazie Hirono and I can work on IP stuff, nothing else. But Sherrod Brown, but it's also building a personal dimension to it, not just being transactional, but really investing in relationships. And it was a Chapel Hill class, actually, I spoke to virtually. A few months back, I said, how many of you think that the Republican and the Democrat members in the banking committee just really hate each other? And about half of them raised their hands. I said, well, that may be true in a couple of cases, but Sherrod and I have developed an interesting relationship that was first founded in talking about baseball and talking about Ohio, talking about North Carolina. But back when Raskin was up for the supervisory position at the Fed, we told Sherrod that there were five nominees, there were six that he wanted to mark up. And we said, there are five, you can hold a hearing, we'll mark them up, we'll vote whichever way we want to, but you can't include Raskin on the markup. And he, laid down the gauntlet and included Raskin. So we decided to boycott the committee, which denied him quorum in a 50-50 Senate. So the markup failed. About two or three hours later, I was on the floor, and he was with two or three other Democrats. I went over to talk to him. He said, tell us. He talks with the real raspy voice. Why weren't you at the committee? I said, man, I'm sorry. I had a prior commitment. He said, what was the prior commitment? I said, I committed to me. I was going to boycott your hearing. But in that moment, in the day that we had boycotted his hearing, denied his markup, I said, now that we've settled that, I need your help with LIBOR transition. It's very, very important to the banking industry. A lot of money's at stake. I'm working with Tester. Can you help me? He said, sure, let's go talk to Tester. So all that happened over the course of about 3 hours. And it happened because you build that dimension. And you're also direct. I mean, don't lead somebody to believe you're going to work on something that you're not really. Don't just let it die by a thousand cuts. Be honest with people, be clear, be consistent, and deliver on your word. And then what you'll find over time is people will seek you out and find things for you to work on. And about half the time I have to say no, because they're too ideologically separate, but that's how you do it. It's no different than in the state house or in business, to be honest with you.
We hear a lot in the media and on the internet about the divided nature of our country and of the Senate. I mean, how much of that do you think really reflects what goes on, and how much of it is just hype from the media to get readers?
It was interesting. I was in South Africa on a CODEL a couple of weeks ago, and of all people, I ran into a Duke alumni trip at the hotel we were staying at. And they were actually friendly. And they recognized me and came up and talked. And they actually thanked me for some of the work that I was doing. We can talk about some of the bipartisan work I'm doing. Some may like, some may not. But they said, they asked me fundamentally the same question. I said, well, first off, we're in a different world where we have 24-hour news cycles. We have nonstop social media. We have non-corroborated reports. We've lost really honest journalism. Everybody thinks that they're a talking head. I said, and that's going to be here. It'll ebb and flow, but that's just the reality of politics going forward. But I said, honestly, it's not as bad as you think. It's not as good as it can be. But you just see it every day. You see these work groups, you see these other things going on, but the outside is going to amplify it. They're going to take the opportunity to get more clicks. You know, media right now is compensated by how many clicks they can get and how many images they think they can get in front of you as you surf the internet. And it's on us to actually lead by example. And, you know, I'm not a particularly bombastic person, but I think we could ask some of our leaders to tone it down just a little bit, because how we behave is observed by others and sometimes replicated and oftentimes even takes it further. And it's on us at every level of government to take that to heart. We're all a part of the problem and the solution.
Now, as we mentioned at the outset, you've been on the Senate Judiciary Committee since 2015 when you joined the Senate, and over that time you've been involved in 4 Supreme Court confirmation hearings, hundreds of lower court confirmation hearings, and we're here with the Federalist Society, for whom judges and the way judges do their job is very important and a very high level of interest in that topic. So given your experience, can you give us some of your thoughts on the way judges should approach the task of interpreting the Constitution and the U.S. Code?
Yeah, but first I need to go back and explain how I got on Judiciary Committee.
All right. When
I was elected in 2014, it was about 3 weeks later, you put in your committee request. And they usually ask you to select 6 committees and you'll get 3 or 4 of them. I only selected 3. That was Senate Armed Services, Veterans Affairs, and Agriculture. Agriculture because we'd not had a Republican on it since Jesse Helms. And so it was the first or second week of December. Mitch McConnell gave me a call on Saturday evening. I remember exactly where I was standing. He said, well, Tom, it was a little bit of an outlier. You only requested 3 committees. And I want to know why that was. I said, well, because I've decided if I can't be on those committees, then I may not be on any. I'll just work off committee on issues related to them. That's how important they are to me. And he says, well, you'll be pleased to know you're on those committees, but I would like for you to think about 2 other ones. And he said, one is the Committee on Aging. I said, I'm all right with that. I'm getting old. I want to take care of myself. And those are my generation, so I'm fine with that. And he said, Judiciary. And I said, well, Mitch, you know, when I was in the minority, I served on a Judiciary Committee. I think it was Judiciary B with Ron Sutton, who was a great chair, by the way. But, you know, I'm a business guy. I'm not a lawyer. I don't know that it makes sense. He said, that's actually why I want you on it. You know, we've got to have, like, Chuck Grassley, myself, who at that time were the business people on the committee. So I said I would do it. Now, moving forward, I have to say the first committee hearings, it's intimidating. I mean, when you're out there with Chuck Grassley, who came in just after Lincoln left, and we use that joke on him too. So, Lindsey Graham, John Cornyn, just go down the dice. Mike Lee, I mean, these Supreme Court clerks, brilliant lawyers, and me. I learned a lot by listening to them. So when you talk about how do you ultimately make a decision to support a judge or not, it just can't be what the party was that nominated them. You just can't be no to everything, because what does that mean? It means that when the tables turn, it's going to be the same thing. And so I spend a lot of time with my legal staff, who are brilliant, and Chad was one of them at a point in time. I spend a lot of time going through their writings, going through their opinions, particularly opinions that have a network where I'm kind of questioning it. It has a nexus with my interest area. I rely a lot on my members to really tease out, because the thing about these nominees is they're really good and coached very well to filibuster. And so we may have 7-minute or 10-minute rounds. So to the extent that somebody else has asked the question about being textualist, original meaning, those sorts of things, I don't spend a lot of time there because I'm scared to death they're going to give me an answer that I don't understand. But over time, you know, I should say that was the first Congress. Over time, then I've kind of honed things into the things that matter most to me. And I could think with Justice Jackson, how I weighed into some of her opinions, and probably wouldn't have done that in the first 6 months if we'd had a Supreme Court nominee. But also take a look at their temperament And I take a look at, in their opinions in particular, things that lead me to believe, you know, we're all human beings, so we're all going to have empathy. It's a matter of how you manage it as a judge. But when they come out and say that empathy needs to be a very important part of the decision, that's an alarm bell for me. It'd be an alarm bell for me if I saw a conservative judge do that. I mean, there are very specific areas of construction that they should render an opinion. And that's how I go about it. And then if someone makes a boneheaded comment, they do a horrible speech. I mean, we got some people that think we're all, I forget what term they use, but it's like these people, they don't have, just by virtue of what they'd said publicly, if it was their career aspiration to become a judge, then you've got bad judgment and bad temperament. I'm going to vote against you. Now, at the end of the day, I'm probably second only to Lindsey Graham in terms of voting to confirm some judges, and I stand by the decisions that I've made. But the majority I'm going to vote against. I think I've voted for maybe 25% of the circuit court judges in the Biden administration, and a little bit different posture for the district judges. And but every one of them is like a fingerprint. You got to look at them and do the homework.
And as you mentioned, you've been involved in lots of hearings. Have there been any particularly memorable moments from those hearings? What sticks out in your mind in either your meetings with judicial nominees in private or perhaps at hearings themselves?
Well, I mean, you talk about an honor. I mean, being able to preside over the confirmation of four Supreme Court justices, one that I voted against, but three that I voted for. And I remember vividly the personal meeting with all three of the Supreme Court justices, Gorsuch being first, and then the marathon hearing that we had. I do have to tell you a funny story, and Chad, I apologize, but I was convinced I was going to do this. So, our staff are so brilliant, and if any member is honest with themselves, or staff know more than we'll ever know about a specific subject. We have to go broad and as deep as we can. So we met with Neil Gorsuch in my office, and I spent a bit of time interviewing. At that time, Ray Starling was my chief of staff, and I said, Ray, you got any questions? Ray, being Ray, was ready to ask a question. And then I look over at Chad, and I said, Chad, you got any questions? He got as red as Ashley's outfit, and he said, I'm good, sir. I said, really? You've got an opportunity to ask a guy that's going to be on the Supreme Court, and you got nothing? And he turned redder. I think he was ready every other time, because I let all my staff ask. I mean, I was in an interview yesterday with Larry Fink, and I had my banking people in there, and I said, get ready to ask questions. This may be the only opportunity you ask a direct, tough question of Larry Fink, so knock yourself out. But then with Kavanaugh, So the interviews with all of them were great. With Kavanaugh, it was more about the hearing. And this is one where I had to play a little bit more active role, because this is the time that Jeff Flake was there. It was the day that we were going to vote him out of committee. At that time, Mike Crapo was on the committee. He leaned over to me because I was sort of an informal whip on the committee. He said, we have the votes. I said, yeah, Jeff Flake said he's going to vote him. And then he got accosted by people in an elevator. And so we go doing our final speeches before the vote, and I got a text from the committee staff saying, it was actually to my staff, saying, would your boss go in and break up the scrum that's in there? Jeff Flake's in the anteroom with the number of Democrats. And I said, sure. So I just walked in there. He was in a discussion with him. I said, Jeff, what's going on here? And he said, we have decided that we need to hold the vote subject to additional FBI investigation. I said, Jeff, at that time, John Cornyn came in. We pulled him off to the side. I said, Jeff, you can't do this to this man. You've seen what he's gone through. And you know that much of what they're going through is just purely politically motivated. I will commit to you, and I think I can speak for John, that we'll hold his nomination on the floor. But please release him out of this committee. And until we get the supplemental FBI investigation, we won't take a vote on the floor. And frankly, if I think that hadn't happened and he had been held in committee, we may not have Justice Kavanaugh. And then Amy Coney Barrett, the perfect moment there, because she's answering everything to a T, and she is composed. And it was when John Cornyn said, would you mind showing me your notes? And she just picked up a blank notepad. Every one of her responses were from right here. So those are just a couple of examples. Sorry, Chad.
You talked about the confirmation process and some of the complicated and controversial aspects of it. You know, it seems to have changed in the last several decades. Yeah. Justice Scalia was confirmed 98-0. Justice Ginsburg was confirmed by a vote of 96-3. But in more recent times, again, the process seems more controversial. Votes more often tend to be party line votes. What do you attribute that change to, and do you ever see it returning on a regular basis to the way it was before?
Chuck Schumer and Harry Reid. In the early 2000s, it's well documented that Chuck Schumer had a strategy on holding up Bush nominations. He was unapologetic about it, and from prior to that time, you saw exactly the sorts of vote ranges just on the margins for confirmation. But Schumer started that process, and they started filibustering, and I think it was 2000. Yeah, it would have been around 2003 or 2004, I believe. And then Harry Reid comes up and blows up the executive calendar halfway. He just didn't finish the Supreme Court. So he by definition, created a structural shirts and skins game by doing that. And, you know, honestly, unless we could have, and I apologize in advance if this would make you all mad at me, but if we had some way to return it to 60 votes, and be assured that we have staying power. Incidentally, there is no way. I would have voted for it because it would take that structural change not to make it a shirts and skins game going forward. And fortunately, we've withstood the challenge to the legislative calendar. But if you want to destroy this country, lower it to 51. And then everything that I'm talking about in terms of bipartisan work will be virtually out the door because the politics of people who would come together in some of these bipartisan coalitions would go away. They'd all be challenged in the next primary, and it would just be devastating to the institution of the Senate.
You mentioned when you were talking about how you arrived on the Judiciary Committee, your background is not one of a lawyer, but obviously Senator McConnell wanted you on the committee for that reason. How does that, your different background coming out of the business world, you know, how does that give you a different perspective from your colleagues who may have a legal background?
You know, I think it helps me because I've gotten to a point, you know, a little less so with judicial nominations, but other matters that we talk about, antitrust, intellectual property, a number of other things, they relate to a business problem. So then I can go to the root cause of the business problem and kind of back in the legal discussion that has to be had to solve the business problem. So that's where I feel like I'm on equal or and sometimes maybe better footing to go in and try to work on how to solve the problem, how to explain it to non-lawyers, the essence of the problem. So I think in that way, particularly my background as a management consulting partner at Price Waterhouse, I'm very methods oriented. So I'm able to take these things and translate them in a different way, which is one of the reasons we requested creating, reinstituting the Intellectual Property Subcommittee, because that is something that's all about business problems. The legal, the business problems that are complete, that are created as a result of statutes, lawsuits, where I don't think the courts got it right. These are very technical matters. So that's my oasis because that's where I can go and find work with Chris Coons, Patrick Leahy, Maisie Hirono, Alex Padilla, Marsha Blackburn on my side and others. So I like that one. That's my recharge after we've slogged the heck out of each other in the big committees.
Sure. And you're the ranking member of that committee now. What are your goals for your work on the committee? Any particular projects or issues that interest you?
Yeah, I think for the remainder of this term, it's going to be more on copyright protection and going after bad actors. We have billions and billions of dollars being lost to digital theft right now. Patrick Leahy's really good on that issue. We're not as aligned as we are on patent matters, but the good news, not good news, Patrick Leahy is a good man, but he's retiring. But that sets Chris Coons back up to either be ranking member or I hope ranking member next year, or he'll be chair, I'll be ranking member, or vice versa. And there we'll probably regen the work that we did in the prior Congress on patent reform and trying to get it right. My interest in intellectual property really came from my time in high tech. I was up in at Wang Laboratories in Boston in the mid-80s, and I was in product management and research and development. And if you don't get intellectual property protections right and give researchers certainty with respect to how long they have rights to their intellectual property and licensing, then they're simply not going to invest. You know, that's why this administration's so dangerous, because they're talking about the TRIPS waiver and basically waiving IP protections. That will be devastating, and people will lose lives, because on the one hand, he's trying to lower drug prices. On the other hand, the cost of a drug that's never been invented is zero. And so we're just constantly trying to educate our members and let them understand intellectual property is foundational to our U.S. Constitution. It's amazing. I didn't know it as a business person until I got here. I said, holy smokes, we're one of the few, even in modern times, that have enshrined it in the Constitution, and we got to keep working to protect it. It's one of the most important things for our innovation economy.
Earlier, you mentioned the administrative state, and the Supreme Court regularly wrangles with important issues about the authority of administrative agencies. Do you have any thoughts generally on how Congress should approach those issues in terms of delegation and the authority of administrative agencies?
I, from time to time, people have asked me if I would ever consider running for president, and I've said, not if you were holding my granddaughters hostage. However, I have decided I would run for president with the express goal of transferring power back to the Congress, all of the things that have been sent to the administration over the last 75 years. Mike Lee and I talked a lot about this. In fact, we had a number of discussions with the Trump administration to say, now is there, you're not going to be there forever. And the only time that you can actually move power back to the branch that it's appropriately in is when you've got both branches. And we made a little bit of headway, but, you know, he had people in his administration that they're not willing to do it. Just take a look at how take a look at the CFPB. Chopra tells us all to pound sand. Now he's consolidating financial institutions and becoming a super financial regulator. There's not a thing we can do about it, because we've conveyed that power over to the executive branch. And we could get into so much, so many examples of overreach that quite honestly was rooted in a bad decision made by a prior Congress. And right now, we're going through a policy matter now to where we're getting some support for it, but we believe that there's backdoor authorities that the administration can use that could basically negate. I'm not going to get into the specific subject matter, because we're trying to get some assurances how we can slow the administration down, but they're far too powerful, so far away from what the founding fathers envisioned.
Well, I want to finish with something that's really important to lots of people in this room. How do you think the Panthers are going to do this year?
Well, I'm looking forward to the Browns game this weekend. I'll be honest with you. If they finish over 500, I'll be happy, given where they've been over the past couple of years. I'm really worried about Christian McCaffrey. He's a force of nature, but nobody that size can take that many touches. I'm hoping what we've done at quarterback and wide receiver are going to give him a few more touches. And when he does touch the ball, he runs a long time and then goes and takes a breather. But I love football. I mean, if I had to give up every other sport, baseball's almost up there, but I love football. And in fact, I'm not going to be able to watch the opener, because I'll be on my way to Texas, but I'll be watching it that night, pre-record it. Ashley, I did want to thank you for the work. I mean, when you get this many people in a room, you all know all the moving parts that have to do it. And Judge Numbers, thank you. And Chad, thank you for your – where is he? Oh, there he is, in the corner. You in timeout? I want to thank Chad. He was incredible when he worked for me in the operation. I'm very proud of his work as U.S. attorney. And thank you all, and to all the familiar faces that I see in the room, former House Member Murray, and others, thank you all, and God bless you.
Thanks, sir.